All right, everyone, welcome to this episode of Liberty Lens. I am your host, Big John. And today, you know, Liberty Lens, typically we focus on one issue and try to frame it in terms of liberty. But, you know, we had a little bit of an issue trying to settle on just one until several seconds before the cameras went live today, my co-host and I had an epiphany, and we'll let you in on it in a second. But until that moment, everyone, welcome my friend and co-host, Mr. Mike Tremont. Mike, how are you doing today?
Great. It's great to be with you, John. I hope that you haven't oversold your audience suggesting that you and I have either terribly original thoughts or important enough thoughts that they would be characterized with such a big word, an ostentatious word, as epiphany. I'm afraid that we may have oversold it, but I think that we have a good discussion coming up nonetheless.
That's true. And, you know, being Greek, I have to work in my native language every chance I get. So epiphany.
The epiphany of the Ephesians. Let's do it.
Let's do it. All right. So there's a lot of things going on since our last episode in the past week. The Epstein files are in the news. The economy is in the news. There's a lot of different things we could have focused on. But then it kind of dawned on us, Mike, let's talk about populism and populists in office. Our president, Donald Trump, we've said it more than once, he really doesn't have a political ideology outside of populism. He responds to what he thinks the people are for at any given moment. If 50% plus one want it, our president will try to deliver it, right? That seems to be his position on everything.
Yep.
But that can be a double-edged sword, right? So, Mike, why don't we start by, I'll let you talk now. What actually how would you define populism in a modern political context right now? It's just to set the stage for the people. When we say Trump is a populist, what do we mean by that?
I think a populist is someone who positions his policies and politics in the context of anti-institutionalism. Anti-institution. In other words, a man of the people, or in some cases, a woman of the people, as opposed to institutions. And one of the things that we're going to explore today is the extent to which that, you know, those two things don't necessarily have to be two different things. But it is fundamentally a skepticism of government, of big corporations, big business, not just big pharma, but big opaque ways of doing things in our country and around the world, obviously, especially multinational and international constructs that take away power from what we think of as decentralized democratic authority going all the way down to the individual. As libertarians and as populists, libertarians love the idea of pushing power all the way down to the individual as far as possible, from the federal government to the state government, from the state government to local governments, from local governments down to individual community groups and all the way down to individuals. That's what it's all about. And that dovetails with populism, where sometimes populism and libertarianism go in two different directions, is that libertarians are all about protecting your individual rights and liberties. And if that means doing so with an institution, then that's what we're going to have to do, because sometimes right. It takes one to know one. Sometimes it takes an institution to stand between you and Big Brother to protect your rights and liberties. And, of course, it always comes down to what do you mean by an institution, right? We have often used the word to characterize things like marriage, things like family. You know, these are things that we might call institutions that we want to protect from government. I think a populist or a libertarian would agree with that wholeheartedly.
So I'm sorry. I just want to jump in for a second, because I agree with everything that you said, but I want to draw that distinction a little bit more, not just with libertarianism, but let me generalize it a little bit more, Mike. Describe to me when populism clashes with individualism, which I think, let's take the politics out of it. Not libertarians, not conservatives or anything. Populists versus individualists. Highlight that difference for me, because some people might be like, isn't populism looking out for the individual?
Well, populism is ostensibly looking out for the individual. Where it goes awry is when a politician, and I think that this is, you asked me to stay out of the political sphere, but I think this is the context in which it matters. When a politician or anyone else who is trying to wield power, when someone says they're here to protect you, and I am going to have to exert my authority to do so, to advance your interests. And sometimes that means I'm going to have a great deal of power and not have it limited by traditional institutions that I'm going to claim have separated you from living the life that you have always wanted. So the examples that we're going to talk about today include the third one that you and I talked about most recently was the Fed, because it has been in the news, especially the last half hour, but yes, the last 24 hours. Here we have a White House, very populist White House, suggesting that the Fed has behaved in a way that is not in your interest.
Right.
A libertarian would say, that's right, the Fed has been too politicized. A populist, like the White House currently, says, it's not politicized enough. I'm going to take control over it.
Right. So to sort of now bring it a little bit more context into what's happening today, we're talking about the president in this particular case being a populist is saying, I want Jerome Powell to cut those rates. And the reason I want him to cut those rates is because I say inflation has not gone up. I say that the economy is booming. And to keep interest rates artificially high is stupid. And you could trust me, people, because I am working for you. Now, here's where it gets divorced a little bit. A libertarian would say, get rid of the Fed, right? We that's one of our things, right? End the Fed. Ron Paul, rah, 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 end the Fed. So why would someone who ostensibly might call himself a libertarian the way you and I might say, wait, Trump is perhaps not acting wisely and certainly not acting in the best interests of the people. After all, he is a populist, and there's people out there, Mike, a lot of them who are saying, we trust President Trump. We have our faith in him. Let him do what he wants. What's the issue here? Why don't we let him
run? What could go wrong, John?
That's what I'm saying, Mike.
President Trump is no different from most politicians around the world, especially heads of state, in that he wants his central bank to create more money, to allow for more inflation, and to allow interest rates to come down, at least interest rates not adjusted for inflation, which is another important concept that needs to be teased out. The president wants to exert greater control over monetary policy. Mm. When we say end the Fed, the reason for that is because we don't want there to be an institution that just willy-nilly continues to pump money into our system, create inflation, undermine the value of the dollar, and in effect contribute in the long run to the exacerbation of the boom-bust cycle. We want to end all of that.
We want the market to decide the value of our currency. The boom and bust cycle should come, those cycles should come as a natural outgrowth of the markets deciding prices, deciding supply and demand.
That's right.
Whereas, correct me if I'm wrong now, because again, I'm the slow one of this pair. I'm not the Austrian economist with a PhD in my hand. The president, however, that's not what he's after when he wants to fire Jerome Powell. He wants to fire Jerome Powell because Jerome Powell is putting the brakes on cutting interest rates. The president wants to print more money. The president wants to, quote, stimulate the American economy.
Right.
He wants to, quote, make America great again. All three of which are not necessarily demonstrably wrong at this point, right? We're still the biggest economy in the world, all that fun stuff. But without getting into the he said, she said, the reasons for wanting to fire Jerome Powell, an individualist would or a free marketeer would have a very different reason for why we want to get rid of the Fed as opposed to Trump, who just sees it as a way of seizing more control over the American economy.
That's right.
Do you think that's an accurate sort of assessment?
It is an accurate assessment. The president wants to get rid of Jerome Powell. He wants to replace him with someone that he can better control and someone whom he believes would do a better job of pumping more money into the economy, thereby allowing some inflation and getting the economy rolling even harder than it's rolling right now. Whereas from the libertarian point of view, I should say from the conservative economic point of view, we want the Fed to button up. What I would prefer is to completely end the Federal Reserve Board and replace it with a rules-based system, which is to say monetary policy would basically be run off of a laptop at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York.
How very Milton Friedman-ish of you.
All you would have to do is set a rule that said the government is not allowed to create money more than a certain amount. And that particular amount is not as important as having a rule itself. In other words, whether you said monetary policy was going to allow money to increase by 1% a year, 2% a year, or 3% a year is not nearly as critical as having a rule saying it's not going to just be able to make up its mind willy-nilly from one year to the next. In other words, take away the power of the Fed, depoliticize it, whereas the president wants to do the opposite, which, by the way, creates even more incentive to end the Federal Reserve Board. You know, the last thing you want is for the Fed to get dumber instead of smarter and all of a sudden be controlled by politics coming out of the White House. And the president wants the Fed to be controlled by someone who is doing his bidding, someone who would create more money, allow more inflation. We understand all that. This is what it is that many countries around the world have done, and it has led to their economic demise. What works, in fact, one of the major reasons that the American economy has done so much better the last century than others is that our central bank has been in control of our money supply and not allowed it to be controlled by elected officials. As frustrated as we are with the Fed, and we should be, and we have reason to be frustrated with the Fed because it targets 2% inflation instead of zero and misses its target, the Fed is happy because inflation is running at 2.7% year over year. I don't understand how you celebrate that when your target is no more than 2%. But okay, so we're extremely frustrated with the Fed. But as much as we are, that's actually better than the way central banks work in the rest of the world. And so that is to be avoided, is having our monetary policy under greater control from elected politicians.
And again, I think you said something in there that I want to touch on from the perspective of populism. You know, you were talking about how the monetary supply goes up and down and how the Fed should be independent if it were to exist at all. And then you kind of paused and said, we all get that. But I would challenge you on that. I don't think we all get that. And in the context of populism, here's something that's interesting. Populism, you said, is a distrust of institutions. And to your point, with good reason, Americans have every reason to be distrustful of their big institutions, government, universities, all that stuff. We hear you. But at the same time, I don't know how many Americans who comprise the populist base understand what you just said about the economy. Why would cutting interest rates stoke inflation? Why do tariffs increase inflation? $300 billion that the White House is claiming were brought in by tariffs, and people are cheering that. How many of them understand that American companies paid that? Not Chinese companies, not Canadian companies, right? So to the extent that you just – and I get what you said. It was a rhetorical device. You said we all get that. We all understand that. But talk to me that, A, I don't think too many people do. B, how do we simultaneously hate institutions, but appeal to them in some way to help formulate what we as the people want to see happen.
It's a very difficult proposition, and it means depoliticizing these institutions. Mm. Keeping the Fed at arm's length is what is critical for success of our monetary policy. In other words, never mind going through all the math, never going through all the history of monetary policy and swings in the dollar, contributions of swings in currency markets to recessions and the Great Depression. Never mind all that, right? Let's suppose that you just don't trust any economist or historian or mathematician. That's fine. I've known plenty I wouldn't trust also. So, you know, I don't have a problem with that per se.
Right.
Surely we can all agree that the people that we want to control these technical matters, we don't want them to be abusing these institutions in order to get themselves elected. Mm. So we want them to either have as little power as possible, or we want them to be controlled from the bottom up.
Right.
In the case of the Federal Reserve System, we need for it to be at arm's length, and I would argue we want it to be controlled so that it can't run amok. And this is, the Fed operates outside of the court system. And that is a challenge and a problem. I'm not suggesting there's a court system that would help us out here.
Right.
But the rest of our government at least has checks and balances that, in my view, we need to honor, not because each of those institutions is so terrific. Don't abandon your skepticism of institutions. We all share it. We should share it. And by the way, it is the fault of institutions that Americans have lost faith in institutions. It is not Americans' fault. It is not your fault or my fault that we no longer trust the federal government. The reason we don't trust the government is because it has lied to us about big things like war and Vietnam, right, and how the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq were prosecuted, how it spends our money, how it obligates us to a path of debt that's going to lead to the demise of financial markets. It lies to us about huge things and small things. Right. So it is not our fault that we don't trust the federal government. But we need to lean into the idea that these various branches of government have to hold each other in check. We need the courts to do their job, and we need Congress to do its job as well. So the next one that we're going to talk about, I believe, one of the things that we were going to talk about is immigration policy, because it's really interesting that Tom Homan has had to make this case in public, which went a little bit sideways on him. I think that he should have done a better job. I know you and I say this all the time, but the president is not getting the best staff work. He's getting crummy staff work. That Tom had a federal court case go against him, that a bunch of cases in Los Angeles, the courts put the kibosh on how ICE was handling arrests based on reasonable suspicion. And it was bungled in terms of how the arrests were made. The response to the media was bungled coming out of ICE and Homeland Security in the White House. It was bungled by the media on the right, and it was bungled by the media on the left. And I think it left a lot of Americans wondering, why is it important? What's the, you know, and what is everyone arguing about?
Yeah, and let me take half a step back, because I want to set the stage for this, again, from a populist point of view and then an execution point of view, which is Tom Homan, our favorite Lurch looking head of ICE there, immigration, basically said, and I'm paraphrasing, so forgive me if I'm not 100. He basically said, I don't need probable cause. I can stop, ICE can stop anybody on the street for any reason. As a matter of fact, if they just look like someone who shouldn't be here, we will stop them, we will detain them, we will hold them, we will try to figure out whether they, and I don't need probable cause. I don't need probable cause. Now, this is concerning for two reasons. We've talked about the due process involved in the immigration situation and we've, in other episodes. I won't get too much into that. But the second thing is the one big bloated bill that passed essentially makes ICE better funded and bigger than the U.S. Marines. Someone did a study and said if ICE were its own standing army, it would be the 14th largest army in the world. It would be bigger than the armies of Spain, Italy, and France, I think, combined. So now you take this, you've essentially got...
Right, so Denmark and Iceland don't have a chance. I get it.
Exactly. And this has been turned loose on American soil, but seemingly without constitutional protections involved. Mike, you were a former cop.
Yep.
Tell me about the dangers of profiling and using that and the bad message, someone who has all the relatability of my tennis sneaker coming out and saying he doesn't need probable cause. He can
first
decide
of all let me help him. Let me help let me help Tom. First of all, in fairness, he said he doesn't need probable cause. He needs reasonable suspicion, and in most of the cases, that alone is a true statement, because in most of the cases, these are civil procedures. And federal courts have held that to detain someone to determine whether or not they need to be deported pursuant to a civil action, not a criminal action, requires only reasonable suspicion. And this goes to two longstanding aspects of police work. One is to arrest someone, you need probable cause. Let me explain real quick.
Sure.
To convict someone, we all know that you need the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt, right? Beyond a reasonable doubt is way up here to lock someone up in jail. We come down to probable cause. We don't hold a trial every time we, take someone to jail.
Right.
That's what a trial is for. So to get them to trial, you bring it down to the police department believes that this guy is probably guilty. He probably did it. Probable cause is the standard to arrest someone. Reasonable suspicion is a step below. That's what's required, according to federal court. Reasonable suspicion is what's required to stop someone, to detain them and question them and conduct a quickie investigation. And that the quick investigation, courts have said, just what's absolutely necessary there on the spot. You're not allowed to move them. You're not allowed to, transport them from one place to another, for example. There are some very specific rules. You might have to handcuff them, but you're not allowed to move them around. Okay. Reasonable suspicion, the courts have held, has to be specific to that individual. Okay. So if a cop says, it was, a weird time of night, and people who behave lawfully don't typically hang out in the back of the warehouse in the warehouse district at 3 o'clock in the morning. And so I was a little bit suspicious when I saw someone, and that particular individual was not doing anything that suggested that they should be there, had a reason to, they didn't look homeless and were sleeping. They were just walking back and forth behind the warehouse, looking at the doors and the windows.
Right.
Now, we can all argue about whether or not that's terrific information, but law enforcement is typically able to make the point to the court. It's specific information. It's specific to that individual. I didn't stop because of what the individual looked like.
Right.
You see where we're going already. So
yeah.
Tom had said reasonable suspicion can be achieved by a combination of where they are, what they look like, you know, MS-13 tattoo, yada, yada, yada. And he listed a bunch of things. Now, he didn't do a very good job because immediately the press reacted with what they looked like. We're going to allow people to be detained based on what they look like. And what Tom was trying to say is what they look like and where they are and how they're dressed and their tattoos and what they're doing and who their employer is, all these, right? Okay. So that's to, I'm trying to give him
maximum benefit of the doubt.
Maximum benefit of the doubt, right? Is that he just screwed up how he articulated it because, say what you will about Tom, he's just not very good at his public articulation of his positions. Okay. Maximum benefit of the doubt. Now, on the other side, the court is not accusing ICE of being racist, per se. They're not saying, well, you used, you know, what someone looks like, and that's the only thing you used, and therefore you can't stop these people. That's not what they said. They said, we recognize that you used what someone looks like, and where they were, and what they were doing, blah, 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 blah. But the court is saying, given all of that, that's still not enough. Because reasonable suspicion must be specific to an individual. That you're not allowed to say, well, this, you know, these employers are employers that in the past have had people around here who are illegal immigrants. And therefore, we're going to raid them. Now, that's an argument, okay? I think a lot of people in law enforcement, I think a lot of smart, well-meaning, patriotic people who believe in the Constitution can be on either side of that argument.
Right.
You know, is it unreasonable? I'm not sure it's unreasonable. The issue is it reasonable enough? You know, how high is reasonable suspicion? And the courts have, in my view correctly, but I may be, you know, biased toward the individual as a libertarian, but a lot of well-meaning law enforcement people would take issue with what I'm about to say. The courts have held that your reasonable suspicion must be a suspicion of a particular individual.
Right.
You must be able to articulate what it is about that particular person. So it can't just be general stuff.
Say day laborers in the Home Depot parking lot is not enough of a suspicion to start raiding Home Depot parking lots.
It has to be specific to that individual.
Okay.
And it has to be specific to the situation. It can't just be, I had a hunch. You know, our bosses, when I was on the road, our bosses would say, you better be able to write it.
Mm.
You need to be able to write it. You can't just say, oh, you know, the hair stood up in the back of my neck. You know, that ain't going to fly, right? I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm not saying that makes you a bad cop. I'm just saying it's illegal, right?
Right, and so this is actually one of those better cases of where individualism and populism clash, because you still see a lot of President Trump's base saying, throw them all out. Don't care if they're criminals or not. They're here illegally. That's criminal enough. Throw them all out. And basically, ICE's mandate covers, like, what, 80% of the populated areas of the United States? They could basically roll anywhere, right?
Right.
But from the individualist point of view, it's like, what are we literally going? We are literally at the stage where an agent of the state can walk up to you and say, show me your papers. We are at that stage of American society now, which 20 years ago, 30 years ago, Mike, would have been an anathema to any politician suggesting that we end up where we are now.
Of course it would, and I believe that it should. And I don't mean to lay this all at the feet of the Trump administration.
Sure.
As frustrated as we are with Tom,
yes,
I have said this in the past, it's one thing for the chief executive to say, we need to follow the law. There are people here illegally. We need to get them out. And I mean pronto. I don't want any of this, you know, 10 people a day crap I want thousands of people a day getting out of here. That's your mandate. Go make it happen. That's the kind of thing you would expect from a chief executive, especially an elected populist.
Right.
I don't have a big problem with that. My problem is with crappy staff work that says, okay, guys, go do it. I'll cover your back. Never mind the courts. You know, you go do you. Here's what I'm going to say are the four factors you can use to achieve reasonable suspicion. It doesn't have to be specific to an individual. We're just going to, you know, have these raids on these locations because I said so. That's not okay. And I don't mean that that makes him unpatriotic. I don't mean that makes him stupid. I don't mean that makes him, you know, bad in a historical context. It just means that he's not sufficiently adherent to the Constitution, and that's a problem. And I think that we need to go back to the Biden administration, because while our Democratic friends who are watching this show, how many? Two? I don't know. Yeah. Hopefully thousands. But our Democratic friends are going to say, well, the Biden administration never did this dopey stuff. The Biden administration let them in the first place. Now, if you understand, because, you know, Democrats like to claim that they understand that these are real limits on deportations. Okay, if you understood these limits on deportations, you see where I'm going. Right. If you understood how difficult it is to remove people in the United States that are here unlawfully, then that means you should have worked twice as hard to keep them from coming into the United States in the first place, not half as hard.
Right. And this is where the mistrust of the institution.
Yes.
It kind of clashes, right? Because I think for the most part, because you're already starting to see cracks in MAGA's absolutism about immigration, right? You're hearing calls for amnesty. Trump himself has said, look, maybe if all my big political donors who have farms and hotels and things of that nature that rely on this particular labor force that we're trying to expel from the country, they've already made some phone calls. And he's already talking about, look, if you've been here for 20 years, you haven't committed any crimes, and you've worked hard, and you're paying your taxes, maybe we'll come up with some amnesty. And now you're starting to see the populist crack.
Sounds like a Democrat.
Right? Sounds like a Democrat.
Or at least John McCain.
Not surprising, considering that Trump, as we all know, is just a Democrat from Queens. But anyway,
his words, point, not yours.
His words, right. But here's the thing, right? So we're seeing that split. But to your earlier point, it's the mistrust of the overall institution. We should have had a much more streamlined, and we still need a much more streamlined legal immigration process. It shouldn't take 15 years and $100,000 to become a legal green card holder in the U.S. And to your point, then it becomes much easier and fewer in just volume to say, let's get rid of the MS-13. Let's get rid of the criminals. Let's get rid of the fentanyl dealers who are here illegally. And I think, Mike, at that point, the populist vision, which is like, we just don't want bad elements as part of our this population that's coming here illegally. I doubt you would have too much pushback on that. And I doubt that you would even be accused of violating the Constitution pursuant to getting rid of deporting this particular group of people. So I
believe you're 100% right. Imagine if this had been handled 20 years ago. Imagine if we had better control over the border, coupled with a more streamlined process to get people in here legally.
Right.
Right. The combination of those two things would have ameliorated a lot of concern on the left and the right, myself included.
Yep.
You know, people like you probably included, right?
Sure.
And
Well, you look at someone like Reagan. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but you look at someone like Reagan, who did advocate for this border control, but at the same time said, we are a nation of immigrants. He did not have to stoke anti-immigrant sentiment to accomplish what is only what you and I and possibly a lot of the U.S. citizens here would regard as reasonable, which is like, fine, you know, we're not open borders, but we're not closed borders. We don't think that someone coming here to make a better life for himself, because we are the land of opportunity, needs to be vilified. So I think you're absolutely right. You know, so the populism cuts both ways on that.
If it had been handled differently 2 decades ago, we'd be in a very different position politically, in a much better position. The one remaining thing that I wanted to mention about the deportations and about reasonable suspicion.
Sure.
Is that in many of these cases, I shouldn't use the word many because that's what sets people off. In some of these cases, it's not just a civil proceeding. It's either a criminal proceeding or a criminal proceeding masquerading as a civil proceeding. And by that, what I mean is when we deport people to El Salvador to stay in a prison, for all practical purposes, that is jailing someone. That is not a deportation.
Right.
That is not what Americans, and I don't believe historical, traditional American jurisprudence would call a deportation.
Right.
To put someone in jail in any other context in the United States requires probable cause to make the arrest and then a trial to reach beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
And when you erode those, first of all, you erode the arrest all the way down to reasonable suspicion. And then you don't have a trial at all. And you just send those people to jail. I think that's a double violation of the Fourth Amendment. And the reason this is important is not because, as J.D. Vance would accuse me of, you know, I want these people to stay in my communities. That is a moronic argument. As much respect as we all have for J.D. Vance in other contexts, his argument that means we want these people to stay here is just abjectly silly.
Right.
But when you fail to follow obvious historical tenets of due process requirements, you undermine not only what we are as a nation and our government's relationship to the Constitution, but, and this ought to matter to JD, you undermine the ability of the president's agenda to politically sustain itself, to take root and to last beyond the next few months or even the next few years. You undermine the whole political enchilada when you do things haphazardly and just create, through unforced errors, pushback you didn't need.
That's true. That's absolutely true. All right, Mike, the last leg of this troika that I wanted to throw in the service of understanding populism, both its positives and its shortcomings, is the Epstein files. Now, I know you and I probably share a little bit of disdain about the whole Epstein file thing, because it's rooted in a lot of conspiracy theories and a lot of QAnon nonsense and things like that. But it is fair to say that the president's 2024 campaign, I won't say it was a central issue, but it was certainly a notable issue. In several interviews, he said, I would declassify the JFK files. I would declassify a lot of other things, among them the Epstein files. Now, I will give him some wiggle room. He always caveated with the credible, which gives, you know, it's a lawyer's dodge, right? The credible, because then all he has to say is it wasn't credible. My name being on that list was not credible, right? That sort of thing. But politically, this has probably fractured MAGA more than anything else as of this show, because initially you had the Democrats are hiding this file. They're protecting Clinton. They're protecting Gates. We had a U.S. attorney in the Southern District. Is that the biggest one in the country? I'm not sure, but it's one of the biggest ones.
It's the most important.
It's the most important one. He resigned under pressure from Pam Bondi under accusations that he was hiding files. There were files locked under his desk. And Cash Patel and Dan Bongino were going to drive to New York personally, goddammit, and get those files and bring them to Pam Bondi's desk. And then, much to the populace cheering, the MAGA supporters, we saw DC Drano, Insurrection Barbie, just happened to walk out with a binder that said declassified Epstein files on it, right? They made that big photo op. And Pam Bondi said, give me 2 weeks. Everything will be made public in 2 weeks. Well, that was back in March. And now we're hearing not only are there no more files, but without a doubt, Epstein committed suicide. Trust us. We don't have anything. Trust us, said Kash Patel and Dan Bongino. Pam Bondi then said, well, there's no tapes of his suicide, but if they were, there happens to be a minute or two missing. And then a little bit after that, President Trump himself said, why are we focusing on this? We're doing some great stuff with tariffs, and my God, Texas just got hit with a flood. Why are you people asking me about, come on, let's move on. Epstein was a bad guy. He's dead. What else can he do? And then I even saw some right-wing influencers claim that this was a Biden cover-up, despite Epstein's suicide having taken place in 2019 when President Trump was in office. So, Mike,
yep.
Is this the thing that cracks? Now, let me also say, amazingly enough, this MAGA fracture over the Epstein files, President Trump is like Teflon on this.
Yep.
He's like the Teflon Don.
So far.
It's all sliding off him, and it's hitting Bondi. It's hitting Patel. It's hitting Bongino. So talk to me about this. Not necessarily the Epstein files per se, because I know you don't traffic in conspiracy theories, but more so the political implications of getting into office on the sword of populism.
Yep.
And now trying to avoid falling on that sort of populism.
Yeah, well, you know, it's like I say, live by the story, die by the story. I think it's important for all of us to recognize that you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to understand the reasons why a lot of folks are skeptical about the way that certain institutions have behaved in this case. And so not to feed into that, but look, just to review the most basic facts, there were very powerful politicians involved with this guy, and they were doing the kinds of things that people who were committing bad felonies were also doing, right? That doesn't mean that President Clinton behaved in felonious behavior, but it does mean that a lot of people are worried about that. And others as well.
Right.
Let's start there. And then the second group of facts surrounding Epstein's apparent suicide include the fact that the guards did not do what they were supposed to do. Then they lied about it. And then the cameras outside of his cell failed so that even today, after two rounds of investigation, authorities are unable to say conclusively that it would have been impossible for someone to get into that cell. Okay, those are the basics. So you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to be pissed off about the way American institutions have handled this case, right? You don't have to be crazy. And some of us are crazy, but you don't need to be crazy to be worried about this case. And I think it's important for politicians and for all of us to be able to say that out loud, that you are unhappy about the way this has been handled. It's not because you're a conspiracy theorist. It's because this was handled badly.
And it looks hinky. Okay to, yeah. It looks hinky. That's all.
Yeah. It's okay to say that. Okay. For starters. And then, of course, it turned into a communications problem. You know, Bondi did not handle this well. She got in over her head in terms of promising and demonstrating these binders, and there was actually nothing in the binders that she was prepared to release. There are reasons why a lot of material you don't release. We get that. Let's say this part out loud so we can move on past it.
Sure.
You don't want to release the names of victims. You don't want to release, in some cases, the names of witnesses. you don't want, in some cases, to release names of people who are just sort of in the orbit because it might suggest that they behaved in bad ways when you don't have any evidence that, that they did.
Right.
And you don't want to be just willy-nilly releasing information about a case that you have closed, because that's just not the way we do things in law enforcement. There is value in not succumbing to public pressure and releasing all kinds of information and casting doubt and aspersion and a negative light on a whole lot of people who don't deserve it. Now that we have said that, that, you know, and I don't mean to be dismissive of any of that. That's important stuff.
Right.
But having said that, there is a whole lot of information in the files that is not in those categories. If the FBI believes that it does not have enough information to prosecute people, it needs to say that, and it needs to double down and say that over and over and over again. It needs to be clear. Bondi needs to go in front of the media and say, we don't have enough to prosecute anyone else. Here's what we understand. Here's what I can release. And there's just not the there. Now, she might have to eat some crow.
Sure.
But she's a big girl. She's the Attorney General of the United States. She might have to take some responsibility here. And she may have to say out loud, I shot my mouth off when I shouldn't have.
Right.
Which is probably the case. Right.
Well, I think that point is the one I want to explore a little more, Mike, because like you said, I don't know what happened in that cell. None of us really know what happened in that cell, I would think. But the use of this case as a populist tool, I think, is what's important. So I'm left with one logical conclusion. If I'm the Trump campaign, you either lie to me during the campaign, or you're lying to me now. It's one or the other. In other words, during the campaign, you accused the sitting administration of keeping things from the American public.
Right.
You said, we're going to release this stuff.
Right.
So if I took you at your word then, I am now left with the logical conclusion, you're lying to me now. You're lying to me now when you say there's no there. But if you're telling the truth to me now, which you might be, then you lied to me to get into office. So now I think this is what fractures the populist brigade that's supporting MAGA right now.
And should.
It should.
So, I think it should. I think that we should be pissed, whether you're a Trump supporter, whether you voted for him or not. I think you should be pissed, and not just on the right, not just on the left, not just conspiracy theorists, but all kinds of, you know, in my view, you should be mad at Anthony Fauci, okay?
Right.
Right. That doesn't mean I'm willing to lock him up without a trial.
Right.
But you should be mad. And I think that our institutional democratic framework demands that some people have the good grace and the ethics to stand in front of the American people and say, I was wrong. I shot my mouth off. I thought, and you know, it's okay to say,
I made a mistake.
I thought there was going to be more there than there is. I'm disappointed. I believe that there are people. I think you're allowed to say, you can cover yourself here a little bit. One could probably say, look, I believe that there were further crimes committed by some very powerful people. Apparently, the investigations that took place at the time and subsequently just weren't able to uncover enough evidence to sustain prosecutions. I'm disappointed by that. But someone has to come clean. You cannot dump this on the president. And you cannot dump this on the investigators.
And honestly, you can't dump it on Biden, which would have also been a viable political tactic.
You can't dump it on President Biden. Not that he would know it, but you can't dump it on Sorry, that was the cheap shot. That's but you nice can't one dump it on the Biden administration. And this goes back to something that you and I have talked about before that I'd like to resurrect just for a moment.
Sure.
As we know, everyone in the administration was required to take a loyalty pledge.
Yes.
To pledge loyalty to the president, which I believe was unconstitutional, to illegal to require this of people. I think it was smarmy and unethical, and I would go so far as to say illegal. But never mind that. Everyone did take this pledge. Okay. I have firsthand, not secondhand, knowledge that everyone was asked to take the pledge. What does the pledge mean if you're not willing to take the hit by telling the truth and protecting the president from being accused of a cover-up?
Well, you got to fall on your sword. If that's what I was thinking. If you're Pam Bondi, because I think this mess, I mean, some of it is on Patel because he also made a big stink about the Epstein files while he was hawking his
yep
gear. But this, I think, politically especially, falls on Bondi. And if there's any hope of this not fracturing the base, it has to be that Bondi gets in front of a camera and says, to your point, I misunderstood what was there. I got too excited, or whatever. However she wants to frame it, she has to take responsibility for making promises she can't deliver on. And again, the guilt or the actual outcome of the investigation is almost moot at this point. And I don't mean that to excuse any of the crimes that allegedly took place, but it's almost moot because what's going to fracture your base, what's going to fracture this populist sword is going to swing in the other direction because you lied to the people and you've proven you're just part of those institutions that they so despise. The wave that brought you in on this institutional hatred is now turning around on you because you're proving you're just part of, to use their vernacular, you're part of a deep state. You're part of a swamp. Whether you got co-opted or you willingly were part of it doesn't make a difference anymore. You're part of that. And Bondi, I think, my personal opinion, needs to fall on that sword. If she took that loyalty pledge to Big Daddy, she has to now say, it was my fault. I'm sorry, President Trump. Go get Matt Gaetz or whoever you think will be the next person.
Or maybe she survives it if she makes the apology in the right way and she has an explanation. But she has to take responsibility.
Sure. Sure.
And to bring this full circle back to your opening for this episode.
Your original premise, yes.
The original premise. You can be a libertarian, which is to say we don't expect much from government.
Right.
But the one thing we do expect is for the government to help us protect our most vulnerable from criminals.
Right.
And so we demand that there be an investigation that leads to the uncovering of bad behavior on the part of powerful people and other people, too. You know, where libertarians aren't just about protecting us from the powerful, but protecting us from the run-of-the-mill everyday schmuck. You know, we need for that investigation to have been conducted as assiduously as possible, as rigorously as possible, without any political interference, and for the results of that to be disclosed. That's a libertarian point of view.
Right.
The populist point of view is similar, but slightly different, maybe two sides of the very same coin, which is to say, populists don't trust these institutions to conduct these investigations. That populists recognize that there are very powerful people in control of these institutions who are, in many cases, the very same people engaged in this behavior that we're investigating. And when you tell us, as populists, and representing yourself as one of us, a populist politician, that you're going to uncover and therefore embarrass these institutions, you're going to release this information, it's going to show that there has been a cover-up, and then you tell us, no, we're not releasing information. To your point, it makes it look like you're actually part of the problem. So whether you come at this from a populist point of view or a libertarian point of view, which are different, but right. two sides of the very same institutionally mistrustful coin, this must be done. And the alternative is that these institutions will continue to lose credibility and should.
And should. And it'd be interesting, not, I think we're there already, but it'll be interesting to see how much more it degrades and what the results would be. And I don't know that the results would be all that great, to be honest with you, in terms of how we interact with each other. But that might be for another show. All right, everyone. You've been watching Liberty Lens right here on Grumblings Media. Catch us every week right here, grumblingsmedia.com. You can find us on YouTube, Rumble, Facebook. Also, now we're a full-fledged podcast, so if you prefer just listening to us babble for an hour, go ahead, go to Apple, Amazon, Spotify, all the great podcast platforms, and find us there. Until next week, for my friend Mike Termont, this has been Big John. Peace, everyone.